Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Can you believe that we've been living through this for almost a full year? Yes, I know it feels like five. But this has been 12 months of mask wearing, staying away from people, limiting travel, even to restaurants, bars, and events, working from home, giving wide berth to anyone around you. And through it all, there have been some pretty incredible stories. People and businesses going above and beyond, selflessly helping others. If only it was being chronicled as it was happening. Because living through it has been not great, but watching how some have risen to the occasion is something we will want to see, and soon. Enter Planet Access. This organization creates educational and inspiring documentaries, and they've done just that, recording Vermont's story during the pandemic. Yeah, that is cool. With us now is Wendy Reynolds, who is a director, pilot, and eco-crusader, and she's the president of Planet Access. Wendy, great to have you on Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, Rick. Thank you for that wonderful introduction.
Yeah, you've got quite a resume. Listeners, if you've got a question or comment for Wendy or have seen any of the Planet Access films, give us a call, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Wendy, start us off and explain what is Planet Access?
Well, we are a nonprofit based here down in southern Vermont, and we are basically a collaborative of filmmakers and environmentalists and people that really support social and environmental change. And so we've decided to start a platform called Planet Access to basically put out what we do best, stories about people really helping to make this a better world, whether it be socially, environmentally, what have you. And we really feel that there's not enough go-to sort of places to actually find really good stories that will inspire and change. You know, you can go through YouTube all you want, but you kind of get down a click hole of many things that are not good content, good information, or manipulated by media, what have you. So we are just that platform of documentaries mainly, and now we're actually starting a Access Academy, which is kind of going to be like a master class of different experts in the environmental realm.
Wow. How long have you been around, Wendy?
We're only in our second year. So when COVID hit, it took a toll on our progression as well. That's where Community Through Crisis, that film kind of came from, was just we were very stagnated with the travel we could do, the finances that we had access to. So we basically kind of just shifted, went inward, and started to make this film in our own community, in our own backyard, and that's kind of what we came out of last year of COVID with, and yeah, it's still going.
Oh, that's great. Explain the name, Planet Access.
Planet Access. Well, yeah, we came up with that. One of our board members, who's also a musician, and he handles all our kind of marketing and social directing, that sort of thing. He's also an artist, and he's the one that actually designed our logo as well. But we came up with it just because we always were like, you know, if we're all on the right axis, you feel a lot better, right? Mm-hmm. So, and it comes down to, you know, internally as well. I've had a lot of issues with my spine and all sorts of, you know, health issues like that. But when your spine is on the right axis, you feel a lot better. And when the planet is on the right axis, we all feel a lot better. So we want to get everybody kind of tuned in and back on that axis. So that's where it came from.
Boy, when you mentioned the musician, I thought, oh, that would have been a great band name.
right?
I'm surprised he didn't fight to keep it. Really would have been great. It is great for what you all do. Let's get into this project that had you filming Vermonters during the pandemic. Tell us, you know, how it got started, and we're going to talk about, I think you released it in sections, if I'm not mistaken. So tell us about the project.
Yeah, we actually, last year, when basically when everybody was quarantined and that first shutdown came, we had a good friend that was the head distiller at Silo Distilling, Erin Bell of Curiosity Woodworks, and she actually started to ramp their operation and was one of the first, really, even in the Northeast or in the nation, to start making hand sanitizer. She got a recipe from the World Health Organization and started to just shift their whole operation to helping supply sanitizer to the local community. So we kind of went out and we're like, well, what can we do to help? We made a short GoFundMe film for her to get the word out so she could raise some funds to get the sanitizer out there, and they were distributing it for free. They weren't like trying to make money off of it or anything. So we were really happy to help. And from that, we started to look around and we started to find other organizations that were just really just doing acts of kindness for their community. And that's kind of where it began.
And then the film, Community Through Crisis, a Vermont Story. So did that take the individual stories that you had and were putting out and kind of pull them all together? Is that what that...
We did. That's the hard part of storytelling, especially when you have... We did 10 parts, but it's a short documentary. It's 30 minutes, but so we tried to really weave those stories together. And because when we were going through the process of filming everyone, we realized how connected each organization or each person was. Everybody kind of knew somebody else, or this organization was distributing food to, you know, another organization that we were working with, or this organization was growing food so they could distribute to another organization. So it was really interesting how everyone was kind of working together throughout the pandemic process and figuring out how they could help each neighbor that they could.
That's fantastic. What do you hope people will get from seeing these stories, Wendy?
Well, Rick, I really hope that it's going to be kind of a blueprint of it doesn't have to just be the pandemic, right? You know? It's like we are good neighbors. It's in our nature. It's in our soul to want to support each other. And I hope we can kind of remember that when we start to come out of this a little more openly, when we start to really emerge from this pandemic. I really hope that we can all retain the fact that kindness and that sense of community is what really keeps us strong and keeps us moving forward no matter what happens.
You know, it's the Vermont way, and I'll tell you a little story. When I first moved here, 18 years ago from Miami, Florida, and I'd pick up the Times Argus, and at least once a week, Wendy, there'd be a letter to the editor, and it would be from somebody from away. And they'd be relating their story of having visited Vermont, and it might be that they broke down or they got lost or whatever it might be. And they would tell the story of how some Vermonter would just pull over and help them and do the right thing, do something the Vermont way.
Yeah, I agree. We've come across that so often in the last year, but in our years prior of living here, we moved from out of state too several years ago. But yeah, we really feel that, and it is a different feeling here in Vermont. And I really want this film to go a little further. We're in numerous film festivals around the nation right now. We really want people to see and really feel that pride of Vermont, because I think we do stand as a testament to you know, what is good about this, you know, this nation, and what is good about people. So I really hope that it can inspire other people to look in their communities as well and kind of say, yeah, what can I do to help out? Or, you know, just share a little kindness around, basically.
You told us the story of Silo Distilleries, which is beautiful. Another one I love, and had Sam Hooper on here recently, is Vermont Gloves. So tell us about that.
Yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So that was also very early in the pandemic. Sam was, obviously, he shut down his operation of glove making and quickly turned to making masks, many of which I still wear today. He was nice enough to gift us with a few masks. So, he actually you know, cultivated a whole, you know, network of home sewers, gave them sewing machines if they didn't have sewing machines, and had people working from home, dropping off at his establishment, and then he had a couple employees in socially distanced inside finishing off the masks, and they were putting out, you know, hundreds of masks every week, if not thousands. So, yeah, really supporting the community that way, because, again, as we know right in the beginning, all these things were very hard to find. It was very hard to kind of move forward and you know, for, you know, the essential workers to be out there without the proper PPE.
I love when he tells you with such pride, you know, about how he has the greatest sewers in the world there, right?
And they are.
Yeah.
Oh, I watched them. yeah, it's very impressive. You know, and to have, I don't know if you ever have worn a pair of his gloves, but they are
amazing.
Robust. They are amazing. And they're hand stitched.
Yeah.
Know? So it's quite an operation he's got going there. And he was a real treat to film with.
Yeah, they have to be so perfect because of who uses them. Linemen who are working on electrical lines, just incredible. And so right here in Randolph, Vermont, they're made.
Yeah.
Wendy, we're talking about this great film that you made about Vermont, Community Through Crisis, a Vermont story. And I understand Vermonters will have an opportunity to see it soon on Vermont PBS.
Yes, that's correct, Rick. Yeah, we, as you mentioned earlier, yeah, back when we first released it, we could only release it virtually. So we did three virtual events online with live music and that sort of thing through our YouTube and what have you. And we contacted Vermont PBS, and they were so gracious to make a space for us for our film on the Made Here series, even though they were fully booked throughout this season. But they were gracious enough to do that. And so we're going to be airing on Vermont PBS, premiering next Thursday, the 25th, at 8 p.m. So, every Vermonter can tune in. Every Vermont, anyone can tune in. It'll also be streamed on their website at the same time on Thursday.
All right. So on Vermont PBS next Thursday, 8 p.m. on the Made Here series, you'll be able to see Planet Access's Community Through Crisis, a Vermont story. And you've mentioned, we've talked about a couple stories in this film. Why don't you tell us about a couple more?
Yeah, sure. So other than Silo Distillery and Vermont Glove, we also filmed with Salvation Farms, and in conjunction with that, feeding Chittenden up north near Burlington. So they were phenomenal to work with, and you'll see sort of that connection through the film as well. Salvation Farms director and head is Teresa Snow, and she is a Sterling College alum, and she started Salvation Farms after 9/11, believe it or not. She came back up here and sort of started this. It's a gleaning project, but they work with food surplus and sort of being able to get that redistributed back to Vermonters, back to the local community. And through that, we kind of, you know, walked into Feeding Chittenden and learned how their food shelf had been working and getting sort of some of this produce and things from the farms or what have you, that excess produce, and being able to distribute that to, you know, the less fortunate and the people really hard hit by the pandemic. And what was interesting with Feeding Chittenden is that, you know, because they couldn't operate as a normal food shelf, and they couldn't operate their kitchen academy, they actually were helping to, you know, find some of the homeless homes during this time and anyone else that had been displaced, and delivering meals to these people too, that they were, you know, cooking in their own kitchen with some of these foods that they were being able to get from the other organizations we filmed with. So it was really a nice kind of, you know, weaving and trickle down of story.
I have to admit that until I spoke with Teresa Snow, the only thing I ever gleaned was maybe information from an article, right? And she's talking about gleaning, and I have no idea what she's implying. And it's like, well, there's leftover vegetables out in the field, and we go out and glean. We grab those and we use them and feed people who are doing without. What a great project, Salvation Farms. Oh,
yes,
I love that story.
So we are, she's one of the ones that we're working with, and hopefully we'll hone down for the Access Academy, as I was talking about earlier, because she has so much value to deliver to other organizations like her own. She's just a wonderful individual, you know, aside from Salvation Farms, but what she's managed to build with that organization is just astounding. So she's quite an impressive lady, isn't she?
Yeah, she really is. Tip of the cap to Teresa Snow for all she's done. Boy, I didn't realize since 9/11. That's really great. Let's talk about a few more Planet Access projects, because you've done some neat things or have some neat things in the works. And there's one called I Am Pure.
Yeah, that's our latest film, and oddly it came to us through filming Community Through Crisis. The gentleman that opens and kind of closes our film, he was sort of a happenstance along that project, and we've actually become good friends with him now, and it's Nico Horrester of Shire Beef up in Verscher, and he had brought this project to us. Again, he's looking to fundraise for this project, so right now we're just helping him put out a short little fundraising, beautiful film that is going to help him fundraise this project. But we are going to be documenting through Planet Access the entire project. And what it is that there are some actual bison still here in Vermont, and the landowner that has them is gifting them back to the Abenaki tribe. And so Nico has now donated his land also to the Abenaki tribe, and they're going to be moving the bison to his land, and he's going to be helping them to cultivate them and sort of manage the bison that are left here. So it's a really beautiful project that hasn't even unfolded yet, but right now we're helping them film something just that will hopefully help them raise the funds to make this all possible.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Another one that I'm really intrigued by is called I'm Not Afraid of the Dark.
Yes. So that also a very interesting story. Interesting people we get to meet. I'm a huge hiker, and so I've always been a member of the Appalachian Mountain Club. And so I was at a conference a few years ago and had met this gentleman, and he's talking to us about the negative effects of so much of light pollution, and it really started to dig us into that story as far as, wow, yeah, really, that's true. I can't see as many stars as I did when I was a kid. So it's a wildly documentary that is kind of focused on the environmental impacts, but also just focused on the impacts to our own selves, to our health, and to our bodies, and his crusade to sort of start trying to save some of the last dark skies, which there is still some areas that are considered dark skies in Maine, so that's where he's working mainly. So,
and
no pun intended.
When the border reopens, there's one not too far north in Quebec that you can go to and enjoy the dark skies, right? So, oh, I think that's that one's called I'm Not Afraid of the Dark. Can't wait till that comes out. And you'll come back and talk about I Am Pure and that in the future when those are all wrapped up.
Yeah, now, I hope to.
So how did this mission for being an eco-crusader become what you knew, what, you know, you had to do and what you had to pursue in your life?
That's an interesting question, Rick. Yes, because I'm actually, as you read in my introduction there, I'm a professional pilot, by trade. So that was my first profession. I owned and operated a seaplane charter company for many years. And, aside from that, I was always a champion of the environment. I was always, you know, I think I was using, you know, reusable bags like 30 years ago kind of thing. So I was one of those that was the annoying kid that started the recycling program in high school, you know. But it's always been in my DNA, I think, and in my partner's DNA here too at Planet Access. So we just really realized that the films we were putting out had the ability to impact and change individuals. I can still remember being a kid and watching a McGillivray film about coral reefs, and it just having that impact on me to say, wow, I really want to help, you know, save sea turtles, and I really want to help do this, and how can I do that? But there was never any steps for me to get there, right? So I think what we are really striving to do through Planet Access is not just tell you the problems or not just tell you a beautiful story. We really want to inspire you and give you the opportunity to enact that change yourself, or to go down that path, or to learn more about something else. So that's really my goal, is hopefully to be that educator, so people can learn a little bit more and just do what they can do, or do what really inspires them and empowers them.
And you work with, we only have a few seconds left, but you work with aspiring filmmakers who have an idea for a project. Is that something else you do?
Yes, we are trying to, you know, cultivate others, because there's so many great storytellers out there, and obviously we are all affected right now by the COVID pandemic, because a lot of us are not able to travel or finish our work or get funding for our work. But we are trying to continually cultivate others and have a grant program where if they don't have the funds to finish their films, we can raise the funds and help them get the product to the final, you know, to the finish line, and then be able to broadcast it through Planet Access.
All right. I want to let you know again that the film that Planet Access has completed, Community Through Crisis, A Vermont Story, airing next Thursday, the 25th, 8 o'clock on Vermont PBS on the Made Here series. You can also stream it. And Wendy Reynolds is a director, pilot, eco-crusader, and president of Planet Access. You can learn more about their work at planetaccess.org. Wendy, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story with us this morning.
I really appreciate being on air with you, Rick. I enjoyed it very much. Thank you.
So did I. Next up is CBS News, and then we're going to talk about captive insurance. You might not think you're interested in this topic, but trust me, if you live in Vermont, you are. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. The Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. When I got to Vermont in the 2000s, one of my friends said something to me in the manner Mr. McGuire did to Ben in The Graduate when he uttered just one word, plastics. In this case, it was two words, and he was letting me in on something that was very important to the state of Vermont. Just two words. No, not cheddar cheese. Captive insurance. What the? That's right. Captive insurance. I didn't know it at the time, but I soon realized that captive insurance is a special Vermont industry that we should all revere and be proud of. Like most of these subjects that I geek out about, I'm not an expert. I just know where to find the expert, and in this case, it's Dave Provost, the Deputy Commissioner of the Captive Insurance Division in the Department of Financial Regulation, and he's with us now. Dave, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning. Thank you. Glad to be here.
Great to have
you.
Glad
to geek out with you, too.
Yeah, I know you do. That's why I love having you out for this. Listeners, if you've got a question about captive insurance but never knew who to ask, today is your lucky day. You can give us a call, 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Now, Dave, captive insurance sounds like something that you'd purchase in case you'd ever be taken hostage, which it is not. So you better explain captive insurance.
You're right. It is not, although as soon as I got into captive insurance in 1989, I quickly learned then that there are still pirates out there on the ocean, which I did not know.
Yeah.
Captive insurance is essentially private insurance for large companies or organizations or groups. It got the name captive insurance because the original concept was developed for a steel company that had its own coal mines to supply its coal for its steel mills, and those were called captive mines because they were just for themselves. And their insurance consultant said, you need to have an insurance company of your own, too, and we'll call it a captive insurance company, and we'll go to Bermuda because their laws allow us to do that. And that was in the 60s. Bermuda became very successful at this captive insurance business, and it eventually came onshore. And there were a few other states that had captive insurance laws. Georgia, Tennessee, and Colorado were actually first. But Vermont was approached by industry, and we really did it right and quickly became a world leader in captive insurance. So it is private insurance. It's taking money from your own pocket and setting it aside to pay future claims. And one of the great things about captive insurance is because it's your own money, it tends to focus companies on risk management. We're going to use our own money to pay our future claims, so let's avoid claims in the first place. Let's have good risk management practices. Let's have good safety programs. Let's make sure our buildings are maintained so that things don't catch fire where they shouldn't catch fire. So it really gets deep into all sorts of safety and risk management issues, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it is a lot of fun. Why wouldn't they get insurance from somebody like Lloyd's of London or some big insurance company to protect them? Why do it themselves?
Right. Well, indirectly they may. That's called reinsurance. It's the insurance of insurance companies. Hmm. And it's essentially because of market conditions. You or I can go and choose from dozens of companies that are happy to offer us insurance for our cars or homes. Any day of the week, anytime, at a reasonable price. But that's not the way it works in the commercial insurance marketplace. For example, I got calls late in 2019 from paper mills saying our insurance company has just decided they're no longer insuring paper mills of our size. Where can we go? Can you help us? And so it's for industry, it's a much different marketplace. Sometimes the insurance market is just not there. You can't buy insurance. Nobody's willing to sell it to you at any price. And so you're forced to deal with it yourself. And one of the ways you can deal with it is by forming your own insurance company and funding it well. And oftentimes doing that with other like businesses as a group program, but many companies just go it alone. And then you, by owning your own insurance company, you now are open to a whole different market of reinsurance. And those are companies that insure other insurance companies. And so you broaden your market. You broaden the availability of insurance for your company and make it at a reasonable price that reflects your risk and your losses.
When did Vermont jump into this business, and is there someone who's known as kind of the visionary here in the state who got us into captive insurance? Is it you,
absolutely.
Bob? Is it you, Dave?
Absolutely. It's not me.
I'm
following in the visionary's steps.
Okay.
Although I've been in this business, like I said, since 1989 when it was still pretty young.
Yeah.
This started in 1981. This is our 40th anniversary. And so there are several visionaries that really helped make this work. One is George Chaffee. He was insurance commissioner in 1981. Unfortunately, he just passed, but he worked with industry, and Link Miller was somebody who came to Vermont, said, you know, we need a better onshore option. We can do this in Bermuda. We can do this in a few other states, but they're really not working with us very well. We need a better onshore option. So George Chaffee was one of those folks that took this, worked with industry to develop legislation that we brought to the State House. Dick Snelling at the time was governor, obviously a very pro-business governor, and George told me that, Dick told him, take a chance, what have we got to lose? And so we passed this legislation with George and Link and Dick Snelling, and then we worked at it. This wasn't just luck. There was a lot of work involved with this. As I said, George has passed, and people were telling stories of how when this started, George would take prospective captive owners when they came to Vermont to meet with the Department of Insurance. Let's go meet the governor. Let's walk down the street and meet the governor. You know, it's a small state. People know each other. And that kind of business-friendly environment really got people excited and appreciative of how Vermont would work with companies. And that's what we've done for the last 40 years. Worked with companies, worked with the legislature, right. Worked with the governor. Doesn't matter what party. This is very important industry to Vermont. Very interesting. It creates a lot of jobs for Vermonters, brings in a lot of tax to Vermont. So it just has been a very positive thing. And, there's been a lot of visionaries. George Chaffee was one. My predecessor, Len Krause, was another. He was in this position for almost 20 years. Lots of people in a lot of different industries inside and outside of Vermont worked hard to develop this industry here.
I remember speaking to Commissioner Pichak a few years ago, and he did talk what you mentioned, how you have to stay ahead. You know, we got ahead of those other states, and you have to always be kind of out ahead. And it takes a lot of coordination with the legislature, as you just mentioned. We just got a press release noting that the 12,000th captive insurance company registered in the state earlier this year. I put my party hat on because I know how big a deal that is. And it's 40 years in the making. And is that 1,200 all time that we now have had?
That is 1,200 all time. And we're actually up to about 1,210 right now. It's we're very busy the last few years. It is 1,200 all time, not 12,000. That we'd be very busy still. And when I started, I remember number 200. So it's just been growth after growth. There's been some drop off, and we only have about 600 captives that are still active.
Right.
At this point, like a lot of small towns, there might be as many folks in the graveyard as there are walking the streets.
Mm-hmm.
But most of that drop off is due to mergers and acquisitions. At the parent company level, if two companies merge and they both had a captive, odds are those captives were both in Vermont, and so we're going to lose one.
Yeah.
But still, you know, we have new growth coming in to replace that, and it really it just keeps on going. It rolls. And right now we're in what's called a hard insurance market. Insurance prices have gone sky high. Availability, terms and conditions, pricing are out of whack in the market, and so we're getting a lot of new interest for new formations of companies.
And roughly, how much does that mean to Vermont each year?
Roughly about $25 million in taxes and other fees that we charge these captive insurance companies. They all pay a tax on the revenue of the company. There is a minimum and a maximum so that we're not priced out of the market. They also get examined by our staff every few years, for that pleasure, we charge them a fee. So about $26 million, 25, 26 most years is what comes in. A few million of that goes to support our office and our staff, and the rest of it winds up in the general fund.
Mm.
And the thing, to me, more important than the tax revenue, and almost all that tax comes from outside Vermont. Very little of this business is generated by Vermont companies.
Mm-hmm.
They're just not that big. But what really impacts Vermont is the jobs.
Yeah.
This creates over 400 jobs for Vermonters. That's how I started. I started as a captive manager. You know, these companies that are forming captives may not have the expertise to do the insurance accounting that's required of the specialty accounting for insurance companies. And, you know, if you thought accounting was fun, just wait till you learn about insurance accounting. It just gets to be a lot of fun. And this is a really neat business for Vermonters. Where else can you be? You're working in Vermont. Right now you're probably working at home, but, an office in downtown Burlington. And on a daily basis, you're working with the treasurers and CFOs of Fortune 500 organizations. Mm-hmm. It is really neat jobs for Vermonters of all ages in accounting. These captives generally use attorneys to help with the formation process and to help them run the companies during the years. They work with actuaries and auditors, and a lot of those folks are in Vermont and employed in Vermont. And Vermont's become a center of excellence around the world, so a lot of these people that are working in Vermont are working on captives that are based elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
It is a global industry. A lot of these jobs are with Vermont offices of global companies, but just as many are with local people that have formed their own companies and taken their own expertise and gone off on their own to form a sole proprietorship or a small company of their own. So it just keeps growing. It just provides a lot of opportunities for Vermonters. It's fun.
Dave, you're not going to believe this. I was at a wedding reception once, and I met a woman who worked in your division, and she could not believe that, A, I knew what captive insurance was, and B, that I was so excited to speak with her about it. Do you find many or any people at dinner parties who really get that pumped up to hear about captive insurance?
Well, you can usually just, if you don't want to talk to somebody, you can usually just talk about how what you do for a living and start with the word insurance, and they'll leave you alone in general. it is unusual. It's kind of a quiet industry, but it's done pretty well. You will see in the grocery store sometimes people with Bermuda bags because of all the conferences that insurance people go to and come back with grocery bags, big canvas bags with Bermuda on the side that they'll bring to the grocery store. So you'll see some of those around town on occasion, but it is kind of a quiet industry.
Yeah, but really a great one for Vermont. Let's go to the phones. We'll start with Fred, who's calling us from Newberry. Hi, Fred.
Morning.
Hey,
I got a good one for you. I got a long-term health care policy that I've had for 15 years, and the insurance company pulled a rug out from under me. And now they've increased the price of the premium by 40% or 30% anyways. And then the copay now is going to be $30,000. Hmm. Is it possible for me to buy a insurance policy that will pay for my health care insurance, pay the premium? In other words, my premium is going to go up to about, I'm trying to figure it out. I think it was around $2,500 a year. Now it's going to go up to about $3,500, $3,600 a year.
Well, Fred, I'm not exactly sure that's a question that Dave can answer. We're talking about captive insurance. Dave, kind of out of the realm of what we're discussing, I think?
It absolutely is, although captive insurance is really commercial insurance. We do not provide insurance to individuals, because it's a completely different set of regulations.
Mm-hmm.
Captive insurance, traditional insurance regulation is trying to protect the individuals. Captive insurance regulation is what's called enabling legislation that lets large businesses do something that they might not otherwise be able to do. So the long-term health care is a completely separate issue, and maybe we can get you in touch with the insurance department, the traditional insurance department who deals with that.
That sounds good. All right, let's go back to the phones now. Michael is joining us from Waitsfield. Morning, Michael.
Good morning. I'm on my way to skiing, but before I was retired, I flew back and forth to New York a lot on a plane every week, and I love sitting with the people from the captive insurance. They supposedly have some kind of thing. They have to have a meeting in Vermont once a year or something like that. Everyone looked forward to that meeting. It was unbelievable. They said, we wish we could spend more time here, but at least we have to come here every year.
Michael, great question. We're almost out of time, so I want to get there. I think we should have an annual celebration. Everybody in the state rolls out the red carpet for these captive insurance folks. But
we have to find – We have to find another industry, a niche industry that needs Vermont.
Well, we're going to try to get to that with Dave. But first of all, Dave, explain what the captive insurance people have to do every year.
Sure. One of the requirements, I'm surprised I didn't bring this up already. One of the requirements of every captive insurance company is that they do business in Vermont. And that typically means that you hire people in Vermont to do the work for you. That's the captive managers. That's where the bulk of those 400 jobs come from. But you also have to conduct your board meetings in Vermont, at least one board meeting a year.
Right.
And that means people come to Vermont. Maybe it's just one person from a single parent company, a single parent captive. Maybe it's a full board from a large group captive with spouses and kids along for the ride. So that creates a lot of revenue for Vermont in terms of tourism dollars, hotel nights, meals, all that that comes along with people coming to Vermont to have at least a day-long board meeting and sometimes a week-long board meeting. And that adds up. That spreads the wealth. There's barely a hotel in Vermont that doesn't know what captive insurance means to them. They may not know what captive insurance is, but they know it fills up a lot of rooms. And in the fall, you can go down to the Equinox in Manchester, and I can walk down the hallways and just knock on a bunch of different board meetings and say, yeah, we're keeping an eye on you. So it does generate a lot of tourism revenue for Vermont, and that's it's a great benefit. And people do love coming here. And the industry association, the Vermont Captive Insurance Association, puts on a conference every year in August. That brings 1,000 registrants, which probably means there's closer to 2,000 people that are coming to Burlington for that week-long conference. And that, again, fills up a hotel, fills up a lot of rooms all around Chittenden County, and fills up a lot of restaurants.
Dave, we only have about a minute left. I want to get to Michael's other point. I remember when Governor Shumlin, one of his speeches mentioned Lima, said it was the next captive insurance product. That really hasn't taken off, but there are some other things that your division has that could. And again, I'm only leaving you about a minute.
Right. Right. That did not take off, but what we try to do every year is go to the legislature with updates to the captive law to make sure it keeps up with what's going on in the world. So since Lima, we have added two new kinds of insurance companies to what's allowed in Vermont. One is called an affiliated reinsurance company. The other is an agency captive. And we haven't, you know, those of each, that's only brought in three new captives, but three new captives is three new captives. And it just makes Vermont that domicile where you can, the options are there. And you can find something that will fit. And if we can't find something that fits, very often we'll work with companies. Well, maybe we need to go to the legislature again next year and see what else we can do to make sure that this is the domicile of choice.
Dave Provost is the Deputy Commissioner of the Captive Insurance Division. That's in the Department of Financial Regulation. Dave, that was enlightening. I want to thank you for the tutorial on captive insurance this morning.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
And keep that division happy. Tell those people we love them, all right?
I will do that.
All right. We'll break now for CBS News. We'll be back to talk national news, international news, with our correspondent Bob Ney. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents, past and present, with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall-winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous, full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. The Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. It's Friday, and we always like to start the 10 o'clock hour learning at the feet of the master known as Bob Ney. We just had a tutorial in captive insurance. Now we get one in national and international news. Bob, it's always a great time spend chatting with you each week. I want to thank you for being here.
Oh, thank you. You're giving me too much credit.
Well, you're following up our segment on captive insurance. So I don't know how much you know about that, but it really is a big industry here in Vermont, believe it or not.
That's great.
Yeah. Hey, Bob, first of all, why don't we start with the COVID numbers?
Yes. Yes, the COVID numbers, of course, worldwide. Now, this is very interesting. They're not putting U.S. recoveries in the numbers anymore as of December 15th, and they noted that today. But the total deaths worldwide are 2,439,000, and the total deaths in America are 492,000. Statistically, we're still at the recovery rate, which is pretty good. But again, we've had so many tests. We've had 336 million tests, 350 million people. But that, you know, you have to be tested multiple times sometimes. So
right.
A lot more testing than when we talked last.
And the good news is the numbers, the COVID cases, falling in many states right now.
That's right, Rick. They're falling in 44 states. The Dakotas are having a little bit of a problem of an uptick in it. But 44 states, it is following. The U.S. averaged roughly 82,000 new cases per day over the past week. That's a 24% drop from the week before. So that's a large drop, one-fourth. And with the vaccines, you know, coming into play, I think the numbers are going to continue to get better. Of course, there's the variants and other things we're not sure of. I also just saw where the Center for Disease Control said if you've had the vaccines, both shots, then you do not need to quarantine if you've been around somebody with COVID. So, again, a lot of new information every week.
Sounds great. Now, the G7's been talking about something called the COVAX program. Explain what that is and our involvement with it.
Right. We have taken a change with the Biden administration. The U.S. is committing $4 billion to the COVAX vaccine. And what it is, it's a worldwide initiative. The funds have already been allocated, by the way, by Congress, so it's up to the president to, you know, to get them out there. Then an additional $2 billion over the next 2 years. Somebody might say, Rick, why 2 years? They're projecting that Africa cannot even be vaccinated within the next 2 years unless there's some type of help. So it's sort of a worldwide effort. Now, previously, in September of 2020, the Trump administration said it wouldn't join the global effect because of the World Health Organization and their involvement. So we've now reversed on that.
So it's not easy to get a lot of kind of long-term data when it comes to the pandemic. But one thing we do know is that the life expectancy has fallen, which is kind of a rare thing to happen.
Right. It hasn't fallen since World War II to this extent. And our life expectancy in the U.S. fell by a full year in the first half, in the first 6 months of 2020. So it went from 78.8 years to 77.8 years. And again, it's a big deal because this is the biggest drop in longevity since World War II. And so it's directly related to the pandemic.
Yeah.
All
right.
No question.
Yeah. Let's shift to foreign relations, U.S. foreign relations and foreign policy, and start with Iran and what's going on between the U.S. and Iran.
Well, I'm finding this to be very fascinating. I would make a note for listeners who aren't aware. I used to live in Iran during the revolution, 1978. I lived there and worked for the American embassy and the Iranian government schools. Mm. So, I actually was there when the revolution started. In Congress, through a couple of presidents, I actually worked with Senator Biden's office at the time on some Iran issues. Now we saw, you know, it go from no communication. A proposal was given to the Bush administration. They didn't go with it, but they did sort of behind the scenes, you know, try to engage Iran. Then the full force engagement by the Obama administration with the Iran nuclear deal. First year of the Trump administration, they went with it. The second year after the Secretary of State left and Pompeo and John Bolton came in, the NSA advisor, then we canceled the Iran nuclear deal, and it's been, you know, a lot of controversy since then.
Mm-hmm.
So having said all of that, just to give the history, Rick, the bottom line is that about a week ago, the Biden administration said, well, we're waiting on Iran to make some moves. Where do they want to be? So it looked like, okay, nothing immediate would be in the mix. But Blinken, our Secretary of State, had notified this week our European counterparts were ready to engage Iran. So now it will be Iran's next move. So this is kind of a big step. We've announced we're ready to re-engage them, try to get a second nuclear deal. And, of course, President Biden, I'm going to predict, will throw some new requirements in there on Iran's ballistic missile systems, just beyond the nuke deal itself.
Mm-hmm. And the president has been making some phone calls overseas, so what's going on there?
Well, now, this is really interesting. I'm more looking at the order in which he called and whom he called than anything.
Interesting.
Okay. First rounds of calls were to Canada, Mexico, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, you know, our allies, and a lot of direct calls by the president himself. Some of the other major partners have taken priority, and both Biden and the Secretary of State Blinken have spoke to, for example, Australia, India, Japan, and South Korea. Number 12 on the call list was the Prime Minister of Israel, Netanyahu, who we all know last time would have been the number one call from the United States administration. And this is the big one. President Biden has snubbed Mohammed bin Salman, known as MBS, most famous for the whole Khashoggi affair in Turkey, where the reporter was killed. And now President Biden's taken a real definite turn, and I'm seeing this yesterday when he announced that he will deal directly with his counterpart. A lot of people, Rick, think that Mohammed bin Salman, MBS, is the king of Saudi Arabia. He's not. King Salman is the king of Saudi Arabia. He has dementia. So actually, MBS is running the kingdom, but it's very interesting to see President Biden say, I'll deal directly with Salman, that's the king. So these are signals out there. And, of course, Biden starting the Iran nuclear deal, which Saudi Arabia hates. So I'm just kind of watching a little bit of intrigue here. Maybe it's also trying to tame some of the Saudi aggression in the Yemenis by this administration. Very interesting.
Very interesting. Let's talk about the immigration bill that is the president's that the Democrats are pushing.
Yes, this week, Congresswoman Linda Sanchez of California, you know, who's got a lot of seniority. I served with her years back. And Senator Bob Menendez in the Senate is going to introduce a bill. It'll be the Biden immigration bill. It'll be supported. Now, it's going to need some Republican support, but we'll see, you know, if that will happen. But it's very interesting because of the 50-50 split in the Senate. But the DREAM Act was supported by Senator Dick Durbin, a Democrat of Illinois, and Lindsey Graham, we all know, a Republican of South Carolina, to provide citizenship. So this is a kind of a bold step, you know. President Obama came in, and he had a totally Democratic-controlled Congress, and really they didn't do, you know, an immigration bill in the first couple of years before they lost control of the Senate. So it's very interesting to see what President Biden will do with this. Can they come to terms with helping the DACA, which is a kind of an easy deal to help those that were brought here and born here, you know?
Right.
And what can they do about existing, you know, older people, obviously, who don't have immigration status? So it's going to be very interesting to see where this goes, but he's trying to tackle it head on, you know, as a new president. Very controversial, of course, and immigration always has been. People have been waiting for 25 years to try to solve it.
Yeah. And we'll finish with Ted Cruz, who's getting a little heat for getting out of the cold.
Yes. One thing you don't want to do, if you are a United States senator and your state is basically shut down and you're from Texas, don't go to Cancun, Mexico with your family. And he did that. Now, here's the problem Ted Cruz has on this, Rick, pure and simple. When he was confronted about it, he said, oh, you know, I had a change of heart. You know, I just brought my daughter down here to drop her off, and then I'm coming back. Well, that was on Thursday. Unfortunately, his ticket was booked to come back on Monday. So he had a change of heart because of the political system. He never intended to come back, drop her off, and come back right away. So they've kind of caught him at that. I don't know what he was thinking with this type of dilemma. Now, he could have sent his, for example, his wife could have went down with her, and then they, you know, it was a pre-planned trip, and they wouldn't have had as much criticism, obviously. But he himself going and then saying, well, I was coming back anyway when the ticket was booked for Monday. This is going to be a tough one for him.
Yeah, and we still are in a pandemic as well. So.
Oh, yes.
All right, I'll take note when I become a U.S. senator not to do anything like that.
I will hopefully be your advisor.
You will indeed. First call I make. National correspondent Bob Ney, always appreciate hearing from you and what's going on in the world. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Take care. Well, as I mentioned in the captive insurance segment, Mr. McGuire had one word for Ben and the graduate. But in present-day Vermont, that word might not be plastics, but rather Starlink. No, really. Here to explain what that means and why it could be something many Vermonters will be signing up for in the future, or not, is Kevin McCallum. He's from 7 Days, the political reporter there. Kevin, great to have you back on the show.
Thanks for having me, Rick.
Kevin, what is this thing called Starlink?
Okay. Starlink is a high-speed, satellite-based internet service that has been launched by Elon Musk's SpaceX company. It's called it's a spinoff or a subsidiary or a separate company from SpaceX, and basically they launch lots of small low Earth orbit satellites from the SpaceX rockets, and they can do that much more cheaply, obviously, than they used to be able to do, right? And back in the day when it took a profound amount of money to launch this.
Are you still there, Kevin? Oh, I think we had a bad connection. Kevin, you there? All right. Let's see if – why don't you hang that up, Danny? Give him a call back, see if we can get him back on the line. Looks like a bad cell. I hope he's in a place where we can catch him again. But we've got Kevin McCallum talking about Elon Musk's Starlink. It is a program that could bring satellite broadband to rural parts of Vermont. And Kevin just did a great story in 7 Days. You'll find it in this week's edition. You'll also find it at 7daysvt.com. And we'd like to get the lowdown on what it could mean to rural Vermont. And I'm not sure we're going to get Kevin back. That was bad cell tower problem, not broadband. But we know the problems of each in Vermont and the dangerous problems we have with them. All right, so let's see if we get Kevin back. At I think he might be calling in. And so we're learning from Kevin about Starlink and Elon Musk's SpaceX company. That is part of this. They have launched a number of small satellites, as Kevin mentioned, low to Earth's orbit, and I think there's 100 or so out there that would help someone have broadband by satellite. We have Kevin back?
I am back. Speaking of connectivity issues in Vermont,
yeah.
Here we have it. Perfect example.
Touché. So this Starlink system, is anyone using it in Vermont right now?
Well, that was the reason I wanted to look into it, because there were people from the state who were saying, hey, you know, we've got this Starlink program coming up, and it might be a solution to rural broadband problems. And so I checked in a few months later, and I said, hey, Starlink, you guys got any customers here? And they said that they weren't able to tell me that. They weren't going to tell me how many. They weren't going to really reveal a lot of their early plans. And so I started rooting around, and I found a few, for sure. I found one in Stowe who had set up his only a few days before, and I found another individual, a guy up on the hill named Dennis Rowland, who was in Waterbury, and both were using it, and both were testing it, and both were finding very, very high speeds compared to what they'd been used to.
That's great to hear. Now, there's an initial cost. How much is that?
Yeah, so one of the downsides, I will say, and probably one of the major limitations to Starlink really taking off is going to be the initial startup cost. You've got a almost $600 dish cost. It's $4.99 plus tax plus delivery, so it comes out to almost $600, and then it's $99 a month. So There's a lot of people who are going to cringe at that and say that's a little rich for my blood. But when you think about it, it's actually not that far and not that much more expensive than what a lot of the current services are charging for high-speed internet.
How many homes in Vermont, Kevin, are without broadband internet access right now?
So in 2019, the Department of Public Service did a report that showed about 70,000 homes in Vermont don't have high-speed internet access. That's not the service. That's access. That means even if they wanted to plunk down $75 a month for high-speed internet, they couldn't get it. Hmm. And high-speed internet is defined as 25 megabits per second upload and 3 megabits per second download, if I have that right. I think I have those flipped. It's 25 download and 3 upload. And so that's higher than 70,000 homes had the ability to connect to in 2019. Last year, the state pumped a bunch of money, a lot of federal money, actually, because of the concerns about connectivity during the pandemic, into expanding that, and they got that number down to about 60. So there's still about 60,000 homes, though, in the state of Vermont that have no ability to connect to high-speed internet. So that's, you know, for Zoom calls, for schooling, for work, for telehealth, all that stuff, not possible over these slower networks.
Well, we've been chasing the last mile for broadband internet access for quite some time now. There is something called communication union districts, and they're trying to solve that problem. So how do they work?
That's exactly right. So these communications union districts are basically municipal organizations that towns can form and join and say, hey, look, we're not getting served by the private market, right? We're not getting served by these for-profit organizations that are only extending high-speed internet to our area if they think they can profit from it. And so we're gonna band together, and we're gonna raise some money, and we're gonna hire some installers and some broadband communication service providers, and bring that service to our town. And most of the organizations that are forming are trying to do fiber to the home. They want to run an actual fiber optic cable to everyone's home because they figure that's the best way long term to get really super high speeds to people's homes. And so those organizations are a little concerned if they're going to lose potential customers to competitors like SpaceX.
Well, I did some math on the 70,000. I just did it on the 60,000. If we were, as a state, to pay that upfront cost of $580 to Elon Musk, for 70,000, it would be $40.6 million. For 60,000 homes, it would be $34.8 million. Seems like we're throwing a lot more cash at this problem than that would be. So why not pay Elon Musk, you know, and just get it done for these people?
You know, that's an excellent point. And I think there's a lot of people who think that in certain circumstances, that is an excellent way to proceed. You already have a well-financed, becoming quickly established service here in Vermont. Why not just pay the bill for these folks and get them hooked up? And I think the state is probably open to some version of that, but they definitely don't want to be throwing that kind of money at people who maybe can't afford it anyway. So they definitely don't want to, subsidize folks who can afford such service if it comes to their area. So if they did do that, I think it would probably only be toward people of lower means or people with, the school kids in the family or something like that. But they're definitely discussing things like that about how to spend the next batch of money that they're going to get for broadband.
So are there any shortcomings with Starlink? Can we just go ahead and, get 60,000 people, say, hooked up to it right now, and it'll work perfectly?
No, I don't think so. So right now, as you can imagine, any new complex endeavor like this has got some kinks to work out. And all the folks that I was able to speak with for this have signed up for what's called Starlink Beta, and that means basically it's a testing phase. People who sign up and get the service at the moment agree that there might be some issues. there might be times when the satellites aren't able to communicate to the dishes because they're upgrading the software. Or there might be times when the one satellite is zipping by overhead, but there's a little bit of a gap. Mm. In this parade of satellites that are flying overhead, where your dish might lose connection with the satellite, and then there's that, and then there's also a lot of geographic limitations, right? If you live in a wooded area with lots of trees around your home, and you don't have a clear view of the northwest sky, you're probably not going to be able to have a dish that communicates with the satellites, because for reasons I don't totally understand, that's apparently where all of the satellites presently that are serving Vermont are oriented. That's going to change going forward. There's going to be more, But at the moment, that's another limitation.
Well, you kind of shot a hole in my theory, but thanks, Kevin. When will Starlink graduate from the beta stage? Do we know that?
I think it's actually kind of in process. Like, so as I recall, the folks I interviewed had signed up in December, and their beta service started last month. And I think I read that Starlink was so pleased with how the rollout had been and how limited the interruptions had been for folks, and that there were just, I think there was a SpaceX launch just the other day that launched another 60 satellites into orbit, that they're starting to sign people up for the full service as we speak. So I think it will take a little bit for those folks to come online. You know, they've got to get the money, they've got to order the dishes, they've got to mail the dishes, people have to install them in their homes. But, yeah, it's happening.
Pretty exciting stuff. Kevin McCallum is a political reporter for 7 Days. You can read his story on Starlink in this week's edition of 7 Days or at 7daysvt.com. Kevin, thank you so much for this. Really, shed a light on something most of us were not aware of. Really important stuff. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Rick.
All right. We'll pop out for a CBS News break and then come back. It's open phones again for a half hour. You can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255 with whatever subject you're itching to talk about today. And I want to let you know this programming note. Tonight's scheduled games for broadcast on WDEV have been either postponed or canceled. So tomorrow afternoon, we will bring you the matchup between the Williamstown Boys and Lamoille Union. Brent Curtis will be courtside. Pregame will start tomorrow at about 2:15. So no games tonight, but tomorrow, 2:15, you can hear Williamstown and Lamoille Union.
At the Warren Store, we're raising our hats to the good presidents past and present with a sale. 20% off all men's and women's fall winter clothing. Our deli is pumping out amazing deliciousness with old favorites like the number 6 and some new specialties like the best Reuben anywhere in Vermont. The grab-and-go dinners are a great value, generous full-course meals for two. Check out warrenstore.com for weekly menus and to order online. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. The Warren Store in Warren Village is open 7:30 to 5 daily, practicing all COVID protocols.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. All right, let's cap off this week with some seriously good phone talk. You pick the subject, make it fun, interesting, maybe comment on subject we covered this week, like cheese, ski jumping, the arts, or pick your own category. I do want to follow up. Yesterday, we heard from Bill in Moortown, who was looking for some German food and some pierogi. And I was able to tell him about pierogi, but Forbes called in, and I forgot to mention this. He called us in to remind us that Chef Michael of Michael's on the Hill in Waterbury Center is Swiss and offers some dishes that might fit the bill for Bill. Of course, Switzerland has its own style of cooking, but because it borders Germany, France, Italy, you get a lot of those influences in the cooking there. So there's German and French and Italian influences in what the Swiss will make. And so maybe Bill will find what he's looking for. Thanks to Forbes for that recommendation. Chef Michael of Michael's on the Hill. Our numbers to call in, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can sell something a la the Trading Post. I'm going to read some calls that we've had this week on the Trading Post for people who are looking for items. I'll let you know some of those, and maybe you can help them. But otherwise, call in, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. And we already have an email from someone who wants to remain anonymous, and we might be able to find a follow-up story. Danny, there was a story in New Hampshire about this. If you can see if maybe the AP News has a story, and you'll know what I'm talking about once I read what I got from this listener. It says, has anyone ever gotten a ticket for this? They should, and I believe it's an actual law, and she mentions ice slabs on cars. Perhaps meter readers doing the rounds could start putting warnings on the parked cars in downtowns. I counted over 30 vehicles in a short ride on Route 2 from Montpelier to Waterbury recently. These death slabs have got to go. Companies should also tell their employees not to drive company vehicles without removing these slabs. And she's talking about the on the top of the roof mainly. They can also be on your front bonnet there on your hood. It's not good for business. I've had a large death slab fly off an 18-wheeler on the interstate in front of me. I can personally vouch for how close to death I came from one of these slabs. It might be too controversial, but a Vermont and every snowy state problem. And I believe this happened in New Hampshire, where one of these, as our listener calls them, death slabs, ice death slabs, flew off, crashed into the windshield of a driver behind them, and actually was ticketed for that. So that was in New Hampshire, but I believe we also have a law about that. So if anyone knows, let us know what you know about the law. But it's not just that it needs to be legislated, as this listener points out, which I think it has been, but it's common courtesy, safety. You wouldn't want it happening to you. So think about that before you drive off. Take the extra moment to remove the ice and snow off the top of your vehicle and do the right thing, because it really can be quite dangerous. And as this person noted, when it happens to you, it flies off, and even if it doesn't hit you, it might hit in front, and you swerve on an already probably precarious roadway, and could cause a really serious problem. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. Have the open phones here for you up until 11 o'clock. We'll finish off the week with the open phones. And I mentioned the Trading Post, which we do weekday mornings. We're here about 6:45 doing that. And I get the cows calmed down, and then we start the Trading Post. And I'm going to read some items that people have been looking for this week, and we'll get to those. But it looks like, well, we're going to get the phone started pretty shortly here. Our numbers again, 244-1777, 877-291-8255. And all right, so here's a few people we heard from this week. You might not be up at 6:45 or have your radio on quite then. I'll let you know some of the things people are looking for. Betty in Randolph is looking for old maple sugar molds. And if you have those, Betty's company makes candies and looking for some new shapes and or old shapes, you can call her 272-6249. And we also heard from Lynn in Berlin. We actually heard from her and the girls in the barn, including Sunshine, who actually does notice when I start to speak. So got a little thing for Sunshine. Lynn needs first or second cut wrapped round balls of hay, or bales of hay, sorry, for the girls in the barn. And if you've got that, first or second cut wrapped round bales of hay, 229-1716, let Lynn know. All right, let's go to the phones, and Andrea's joining us. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I'm just thinking, as you read about the snow icebergs coming off people's cars, and
yes,
a consideration for legislating that. Where have we come in this world as a society where we can't function common courtesy and appropriate behavior without having legislation for a law on something? That's my question.
Well, I agree.
I just don't get it. We're as a people concerned about your neighbor or yourself.
Or yourself.
Why do you have to be legislated or under a law to act as a human being with common courtesy?
And, Andrea, if we all did the right thing, we wouldn't need any legislation, right? We'd all help each other. We'd all do the right thing every single day. Unfortunately, we're human. I'm not calling for a law, but I think there might be one. I'm going to read what we found from AP, thanks to Danny, who pulled this out. A box truck driver who was accused of not clearing snow and ice from his roof dislodged and struck a car, injuring the driver. This is in Londonderry, New Hampshire. has pleaded guilty to a negligent driving violation. So I believe it is a motor vehicle violation now in New Hampshire. If anyone knows for sure if it is in Vermont, let us know. But as Andrea says, Andrea, I love your point. I think you're spot on. Do we need these things legislated? You know, common sense, common courtesy. This is Vermont. We tend to do the right thing, you know, a lot of the time, most of the time. Cleaning the top of your car, cleaning the hood off, it doesn't take that much longer. You will get to work, you know, or to wherever you're getting to on time. Trust me, if you slow down, if you clean off your car. And Andrea, I agree with you. Do we need legislation for this? We probably don't, but we probably do. All right. All right. Thanks, Andrea.
Amen, brother.
All right. Take
Have
care.
A good day.
You too. Thanks for calling. Our numbers are 244-1777, 877-291-8255. All right. I'm going to go back to some of the Trading Post looking fors. You heard from Betty, from Lynn. We heard from Art in Randolph, and he is looking for a wooden bar, 6 to 8 feet long. This is for his daughter. And this is not a wooden bar like a clothes bar, but actually one you'd belly up to for drinking. And if you've got something like that, maybe in your basement that you're not using anymore or used to own a bar, Art is at 431-3749. Looking for a wooden bar, 6 to 8 feet long. His daughter's looking for it. You can call Art, 431-3749. We've got Dale next in Burlington. Hey, Dale, how you doing?
Good morning. I think I have an answer for your negligence in not removing snow from the top of your vehicle.
All right. Love to hear it.
I believe the state legislature, Vermont state legislature, passed a bill just saying that, where it is an enforceable offense and you are liable for a violation if it occurs.
Yeah.
I believe it was introduced by former Representative Wright from Burlington, among others, back, guessing 8 years ago, maybe.
Wow. We're pretty progressive in that, but we're not paying attention to it. So maybe, if nothing else, Dale, I really appreciate your call. If nothing else, our listener who wrote in, and Dale and Andrea, just bringing it up this morning, will remind people that, for one, it's a bad thing not to do it, but also you could receive motor violation for not clearing off the top. And, you know, cars, it probably doesn't cause too much damage. SUV, maybe a little bit more. You know, if you're driving a bigger truck like a box truck or a tractor trailer, if you're not clearing the top of that off and that ice mounts and it flies off, that can cause some serious problems. So please do the right thing. You can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Paula did. She says, how would a truck driver be able to get the snow off his big rig? Any truck drivers out there know? I think there's a way. I'm pretty sure there's a way. Do you need a roof rake? I think there might be something at the terminal that would help you, but we'll ask for help on that one. I don't know for sure, Paula, but it's a great question. Let's go to the phones again. Jerry's calling from Montpelier. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, good morning. How are you doing?
Good. How about you?
I'm great. I missed something earlier, and
okay.
I missed the show on it. You just mentioned pierogi.
Pierogi, right.
Well, it's pierogi. But anyhow, I was brought up on it. Not every day, but my parents used to cook it all the time, and my grandmother cooked it all the time. And I think you said it is from German orientation?
Well, I'm German, and my German grandmother made it. My Slovak grandmother made it, but I know it comes from Poland. It's Polish. It's definitely Polish. And Louisa, Louisa's Made with Love, is out of the Shelburne area. And she makes it. You can find her online. You can find her on Facebook. And, you know, it's she.
Oh, we still make it.
You still make it. Oh, fantastic.
Oh, yeah.
Do you make gowumki?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding me?
Oh, I would imagine.
That was my favorite. I used to run into the kitchen and help my grandmother do that.
Oh, that's fantastic. Wow.
Oh, yeah. All sorts of, I was brought up on Polish food.
Yeah, you were.
I mean, for everything from kibasi to, from gorumki to pierogi to, and of course the big cabbage eaters.
Yeah.
The thing is during that time where everything was happening with pierogi and everything else, the whole area wasn't just Poland or Germany or those countries back then. It was,
yeah.
I mean, my father used to say Poland owned everything, but of course he was a proud Polak. So
My Slovak grandfather was from right across the border, right across the Tatry Mountains from Poland. So the cultures are very similar, and the foods. And so, Jerry, hey, thanks so much for kielbasa and sauerkraut, one of my favorites. I just finished them off last week. So, hey, thanks for the call, Jerry. You take care. Let's go right back to Montpelier. We've got Bill calling. Hi, Bill.
How you doing?
Great.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Love your show, Rick, by the way.
Thank you.
So as a professional driver, I hold a CDL Class A license.
Okay.
I drive for a living.
Yep.
I don't know how the public expects a driver to get up on top of a 53-foot tractor-trailer truck, which is 13.6 tall, and clean the snow and ice off the top of the trailer. And especially these guys who do long haul. When you come into the state, there is no terminal you can go to. A lot of these warehouses they deliver to, there is nothing to clean the top of the trucks off.
Wow.
The driver would literally have to get up on top of the truck with a ladder and shovel everything off. Now, let's think about one thing for a second.
Yep.
Everybody wants people to be safe. You talk about 13.6 tall. You take a driver who's 6 foot tall and stand up on top of that. He slips and falls off that trailer.
Mm.
His head is almost 20 feet above the ground. What's that going to do to the driver?
Yeah. Excellent point. So, Bill, what can be done? Because you've seen it when that does fly off the top of a trailer, even a box truck, even the top of an SUV, that sheet of ice can be, have really hardened and be very dangerous for others driving behind them.
Oh, absolutely. I do not object to people's opinions about that because they are absolutely correct. It is. It's very dangerous. But there is no place you take.
Wow.
Maplewood's up on top of the hill in Berlin. There's nothing up there to be installed to scrape snow off the top of trucks. And is that their responsibility? And it comes down to liability.
Hey, Bill, why don't we go into business? We'll open up a chain of them around the state that will use like technology from like tanning beds, right? The tractor trailers will pull in, put them underneath it for a few minutes. Melt it off, charge them $50, let them go.
There's even a better idea out
there. All right,
go
ahead.
It's actually a snowplow that is on top of poles that a truck actually drives under, and it scrapes everything off the truck. But only certain places buy those and install them for their trucks.
Yeah.
You don't have any place for all these over-the-road guys, these little small carriers, to be able to go to get this stuff scraped off. And then let's throw one other thing into the mix real quick.
Yep, go ahead.
OSHA.
Oh,
they have a violation. If you are above a certain amount of feet above the ground, you are required to have a fall arrest system attached to you so you do not fall and hit the ground. So now you're going to have 18-wheeler drivers up on top of the truck with no fall arrest system. Now they're going to get fined if somebody happens to drive by and say, why are you up there? Well, I have to scrape the snow and ice off.
Hmm.
Well, you shouldn't be up there in the first place because what if you fall?
Yep. Great question. Hey, Bill, thanks for that perspective. I really appreciate that. That is really a great answer. I don't know the answer, but it's a great perspective from Bill. You know, we want that cleaned off. Come on. What's the practicality? We don't know. Somebody knows. Somebody will teach us, but I'm not sure there is an answer right now. All right, what do we got here? I want to give a programming note. Tonight's scheduled games for broadcast, basketball games here on WDEV, have either been postponed or canceled. So no basketball games, no high school games tonight. Tomorrow afternoon, we will bring you the matchup that was supposed to happen. Williamstown Boys and Lamoille Union. Brent Curtis will be courtside with pregame starting about 2:15 tomorrow. Let's see. Going back to the Trading Post, a few people looking for things. Going to try to wrap up all the things we've been talking about this half hour. Kirk in Waterbury is looking for a small potbelly stove in any condition. So if you've got one, let him know what you have. Kirk is at 595-1679. 595-1679. You're probably thinking, if you don't get up and listen to the Trading Post in the morning or on weekday, on Saturday mornings, what's he going on about? On the Trading Post, a lot of people sell things, but also let us know what they're looking for. And so if you've got something that you need, we've had some really wild things people have been looking for from old vehicles, and they have been able to match up with someone listening on WDEV. You call in or you email. You can email tradingpost@radiovermont.com. You can call in when we do the Trading Post, or you can call in now. Anyway, Jeff in Essex Junction, looking for a side-by-side UTV or four-wheeler. If you've got one of those, Jeff's at 324-1227. He wants to get out on the ice, he said this morning. Again, 324-1227. All right, going to sneak her in her. Going to be really quick with Cindy. Cindy, you can't be long. North Faceton, you got to go quickly. What do you got?
About the Pergolis. I have a package in my freezer that I just pulled out, and it says to boil them.
Yep.
But then I heard you suggest to saute them, too, afterwards.
Yes.
Is that a good thing to do?
Oh, Cindy, you're going to love me forever when I tell you what to do. So
I think I already do.
Yeah. Thank you, Cindy.
Right.
It's mutual. So you're going to boil them first. All right.
Yes.
Then take them out, throw them in the frying pan with some butter, and if you like onion, cut up some onion, throw the onion in there as well. It's going to be so pungent and beautiful. And then a little bit of salt on top and a dollop of sour cream.
That's what you said.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's the best thing on earth.
Really?
Yes.
And I like the ones, I like the idea of sauerkraut, of course.
Oh, yeah. There's some filled with sauerkraut.
Yeah, I got a little German in me, yeah.
All right. I got to run, Cindy. You enjoy. You're going to be so, so happy. That's it for today. Thanks again, dear listeners. It's been a lot of fun. Thanks to also our director, Danny McGivergan. And what do we got today? We've got the governor coming up at 11 o'clock. He's got the COVID-19 response news conference that'll follow CBS News here on WDEV. I'm Rick Sengary. We'll meet you back here on Monday for more of this crazy fun.